Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friends Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer. Today, joined by Mr. Mlondi Mdluli. Mlondi, how are you doing?
Good afternoon, Nick. I am good, and you? And thank you so much for inviting me back on the show. It's always a pleasure to be here.
Always good to have you with us. We've also got Makone Maja. Makone, how are you doing?
Very well, Nick. Happy to be spending a Friday with both of you and everybody else that's tuning in.
Indeed, indeed. So just a somewhat bittersweet note, which is that Mlondi is going to be leaving us in the not too distant future. We're very sad to lose him, but he is going into the horrifying, frightful, and terrifying world of politics as a member of parliament, likely for the DA. So, Mlondi, I hope that you shall carry the Liberal banner forward in many impressive ways. We're going to be very sad to lose you.
Oh, Nick, thank you so much for those kind words. I'm also a bit sad, but I mean, you know, we do what we have to do.
Indeed, indeed. All right, let us first get into a story about the National Lottery. Now, the lottery is in theory kind of an interesting idea, right? We have this National Lottery and people buy the tickets, and the vast majority of the money that's collected by the lottery is supposed to go to various charitable foundations. That's one of the reasons why the government said that it needed to run the lottery, rather than have it done in private hands. And the National Lottery Commission has many, many millions of rands that it is supposed to spend on a variety of projects to uplift communities, doing everything from funding training workshops, helping out schools, building old age homes, all sorts of stuff. Yet the National Lottery Commission always seems to get hit with more and more scandals. We've seen a number over the years. On the show, we've covered, for example, I believe it was in Limpopo, but I can't exactly remember. It was in one of South Africa's more rural provinces. The National Lottery Commission was supposed to have built an old age home. It paid several million rands towards this goal, and no old age home was ever built. I think there was also a soccer stadium that was supposed to be upgraded that ended up not having any work done at it. Essentially, the money seems to have just been vanished off by some contractor. And the latest scandal is that the National Lottery Commission paid over 1.7 rand for a Women's Day, quote, flash mob activation in 2021. Now, that already sounds like a little bit of a dubious way to spend your money, right? 1.7 million rand on a flash mob? Okay. But what makes it even worse is apparently no such thing ever happened. In fact, the only thing related to this that appears to have been produced is a rather kind of rough amateurish video of three men dancing in high heels in a gym that was never published online, which makes one sort of ask the question of where did all the money go? So, Makone, I have complicated feelings about the lottery. I think that people are, should be entrusted to be able to spend their money however they want. So if people want to spend it on gambling, I think that should be legal. But I do feel a little bit conflicted about the government running that lottery system, particularly when, you know, the money seems to be going into people's pockets when it should be going to charitable stuff. In fact, if you had forced a private company to give 50% of the profits to, the charity instead, that might even have been more effective. What do you make of this story? What do you make of the National Lottery's place in our country?
Three men dancing in heels and swindling the National Lottery of about 2 million rands was not in my cards of possible scandals to emerge from 2024. But I accept it and should be surprised, but I'm not, Nick, because like you said, at this point, the government has shown that they cannot run basic government responsibilities and functionalities, and now to that long list we've added charities. But I'm always suspicious of charitable organizations, to be fair, let alone ones that are state-run and state-owned. There's always huge opportunities there for corruption, huge opportunities there for swindling, and so the National Lottery has just fallen victim to people that pretend to have poor people's best intentions, but are really just eyeing a lot of those monies that are set aside for their own private use. I am also conflicted also to see the government sort of encouraging and enabling, to some extent, gambling. I would rather that be entirely in the ambit of private enterprise than to see the state aching that on, edging that on through the national lottery.
Yeah, it's, you know, I've heard the lottery described as a tax on the poor, because essentially the people who, as a percentage of their income, and as a percentage, I think, of the overall total, considering South Africa's economic situation, who spend their money on lottery tickets tend to be very poor people who are just desperate, you know, for some good luck that might pull them out of poverty. So it's kind of a bit sort of sad that effectively the lottery has, you know, while it's got this intention of being something that's kind of fun, that occasionally changes a person's life, in practice, it's more of a tax extracting money from some of the poorest people in the country to give it to what we can only assume are politically connected cadres. Londi, what do you make of this story?
Nicholas, I mean, this story, to be honest, it doesn't really surprise me. Like, we all know that the government is corrupt, and as Makone has said already, you know, that the National Lottery has just fallen a victim, you know, to this. But yeah, so like, you know, like, which other, a department that isn't a corrupt? So like, this is bound to, to take place, especially considering that the national lotteries is a NPO, you know. So I mean, it's, you know, so like, it is bound to, you know, to take place, and it's very sad. And this just shows that we do need a change, you know, in our systems, and not just like our balance check, you know, and checks, but also like our whole political system and governments, you know, as a whole.
Right. I think it's very difficult to separate the kind of decay of institutions like the lottery. Although, you know, decay kind of suggests that it was in some amazing place to begin with. But and I think that you can directly draw a line between how the lottery performs and something like cadre deployment. Because considering what we know of how the ANC's cadre deployment committee works, there is, I think, a very strong correlation there between it's very likely that at least someone in the senior leadership of the National Lottery Commission was suggested as the appointee of by the ANC's cadre deployment commission. Bakone, any final thoughts on this before we move on?
Highly likely on that cadre deployment speculation. I will say on the tax extraction point that I think even without a national lottery, so money going towards government revenue, you will still have people gambling, some even illegally. I grew up in those townships where we had.
I mean, sports betting online has become absolutely massive right now.
Huge, right? But in townships, for example, I think there was some illegal gambling facilities called Mochina, which is like this Chinese lady comes around with like a bag and there's a raffle there and you give her money, basically like the lottery, but not the lottery. So there's always going to be people gambling, whether or not it's going towards government revenue and being used to fund lavish lifestyles of caterers, or it's the Chinese woman who rolls around a township and does it and probably makes a good buck on it as well and pays the people who gamble their reward that they do. But yeah, I think with or without government entity, people will still gamble.
Yeah, I think that's very much true, which is exactly why I said at the beginning that I don't think gambling should be made illegal in any way whatsoever, because it is ultimately up to people how they choose to spend their money. And, you know, society should trust people to spend their money as they wish. A lot of people have fun gambling and that kind of thing. But I do think that there is some moral complications that come in when you have a government entity that's, you know, supported by statute and taxpayers' money comes into the picture and starts essentially promoting something. But anyway, let us move on to our next topic, and that is South Africa's Policy Uncertainty Index. So often when you're listening to conversations about the problems with South Africa's economy and why we're just not doing so well in recent years, a lot of business leaders like to use this phrase, policy uncertainty. And Northwest University has created a thing called the Policy Uncertainty Index, which looks at basically how uncertain government policy is every year. and shows a small rise from 65.5% in the previous quarter to 65.8% in the first quarter of this year. So essentially, policy uncertainty is when businesses aren't really sure what government policy is going to end up being because it's all stuck in legislative processes, or because a politician has given a speech which suggests that they're going to do X, and then they're not sure what X is actually going to be. And it's often kind of used as a very soft way of criticizing the government. Business leaders will say something along the lines of, well, you know, if we just knew what the policy was, then things would be better because then we could plan for it. And I think there's some truth to that. But I also think it's often a very sort of sneaky way of trying to criticize the government without being too harsh. Because at the end of the day, bad policy is much worse than uncertain policy if you have the potential to have good policy. So, for example, the president is now considering whether to sign the expropriation bill, which will allow expropriation without compensation. That is a policy which, it doesn't matter how certain you are that it's going to happen, it is going to be an economic and a moral disaster. Nandi, do you agree with me?
Yes, I totally agree with you, Nick, especially on the point that people tend to use the word policy uncertainty as a way to, you know, to dumb down on their criticism on governments, you know. So, but I mean, yeah, so definitely, you know, I do agree. I mean, I want to say that the policy uncertainty, indexed by the Northwest University, should not be appreciated, but I mean, it does raise some questions, you know, because I mean, I think it would be much better if maybe that the index showed maybe how bad government is performing. I don't know, maybe it could have been a better way to maybe interpret it. But but I do think that, you know, there is a lot of policy uncertainty. I'm sorry for using that word, but there is a lot of policy uncertainty, as like you said, like the policies like EWC, for example, are not just uncertain, but they're also bad policies as well, you know, for example. And also if you have policies like the NHI, you know, so those policies are not, you know, they are not just uncertain, but they also bad policies, you know, they just, you know, like they just don't bring uncertainty only, but their implementation would actually harm the country's economy and ultimately its people. So, yeah. That's what I have to say.
Makone, what do you make of this whole discussion? I think, you know, NHI, as Mlondi says, is also a really, really damaging kind of thing. And it doesn't matter how certain people are about NHI, it's going to destroy the health system in so many ways if it goes forward. And I really wish that we'd focus more in the kind of business and public policy space on talking about, you know, good or bad policy. Like if we were arguing between a 5% tax cut and a 10% tax cut, and you know, these were the two options on the table, I can understand that business and that policy uncertainty might be the thing that businesses are most concerned about there, because they want to plan exactly how much money they're going to have to pay in tax. But when the policy uncertainty is, well, maybe we're going to completely destroy property rights in the country, or maybe not. There's, you know, we're kind of missing the point here. What do you make of all this?
Yeah, I think these are academics trying to be perhaps as accurate as possible in their use of language. And so perhaps they are observing policies that come out like the expropriation bill, which I would actually argue make policy uncertainty far greater in this quarter than in the previous, for the Northwest University's index to only make a 0.3% increase in adjusting for the inclusion of something like the expropriation bill, which really did just come from the NCOP a few weeks ago. But I would think that they, not knowing the contents of a certain bill, would not just outright say it's bad, right? They would wait for that bill to come out and see what sort of, to what extent is it bad that they would use words like uncertainty. I think that's perhaps the right way to see that. But I definitely think that policy uncertainty has been elevated by the inclusion of the expropriation bill to the list of bills that now sit with the president for him to sign. Lundy mentioned both the NHI bill and the expropriation bill are within signing of the president, away from being official statute in the country. And like you said, Nick, the expropriation bill, we know with great certainty it does not need to be graded on any policy uncertainty index or metric, will be damaging to this country's property rights. It will be damaging to investment prospects of this country because it does far too much in allowing government to expropriate and seize property under the guise that it's for purposes of land reform or that it's in the public interest, right? This bill came in, was introduced to address the issue of land reform being made, provision being made for it in the Constitution, provided that compensation is awarded to the landowner whose property is taken, that compensation be according to market value standards. But of course, that market value was further subjected to a list of other constitutional factors that the government now wants to adjust that market value for. But the expropriation bill then comes in and says, no, here is an open-ended list, by the way. That's the full sense of security this bill gives you, is that although it provides a list of the types of land that can be expropriated with nil compensation, it also states that that list is inexhaustible, which means there's a greater uncertainty, let's go with that word for purposes of this index, greater uncertainty as to exactly. What types of land can be expropriated. It's not just those five that are mentioned in the bill.
Right. So that's a really important point that I would also like to make, is the way that the sort of, you know, the sort of far left ideological policies pursued by the EFF, the ANC, and some of the parties on the left of the South African political spectrum, the uncertainty is baked in to the design of the policy. You have these laws that have, you know, as you just said in the expropriation bill, is not an unexhausted list of reasons why property might be expropriated. So, you know, they're ill-defined. They give the minister a lot of power to do things, that kind of stuff, which we often see in government legislation over the past couple of years. And that creates uncertainty. If the minister can decide, for example, whether to grant a mining license or not, can be any kind of license you think about, that creates uncertainty because you don't know at the end of the day what criteria the minister is going to use. It opens the door for bribery. It opens the door for confusion. It opens the door for people who shouldn't get licenses getting licenses. And so we really need to move away from granting ministers power, centralizing power, all that kind of thing, towards policies that open up, that have clear, simple rules that everyone can be held to and everyone is understood by. And, you know, things like expropriation without compensation, things like these national health insurance, things like BEE completely undermine that.
You're so right on that, Nick, about the uncertainty being baked into the legislation. There's something that I've also been ruminating on the types of land that are enumerated in the bill as being subject or likely to be subjected to expropriation without compensation. One of them is mentioned is land that's owned by state-owned entities that's used for purposes other than the main or core functions of that state-owned entities. But we're now entering the era where there will be a lot of private-public partnerships in the big state-owned entities, right? Your Transnet. Transnet has been trying to complete a deal with the ICTC, the International Container Terminal Services, that Philippine company that's coming to run DCT Pier 2 of Transnet, that deal that's been going on for over 5 months now. The deadline's actually coming about now in April, when it should have been concluded. What does that say about companies that are now coming in to partner with the government on those state-owned entities? What does it say about property or land that's held by those state-owned entities? What does it say for those private companies that are coming in to do those deals? So again, it just elevates uncertainty. It does not alleviate it. And a lot of that is not addressed, of course, in the legislation, and will probably only wait until somebody's properties expropriated before the courts have to come in and really set case precedent through case law of where exactly the line is.
Right. And of course, when you have to rely on the courts to sort of solve things, people who are smaller landowners, people who are poorer, that kind of thing, they really will suffer because they don't have the money to front up lawyers to begin with. They don't have the money to fight through court battles that go on for years, whereas government has this inexhaustible supply of, well, not inexhaustible, but nearly inexhaustible supply of taxpayers' money that could just throw away on cases, whether it has good standing or not, and crush you with lawfare, which is exactly why these things should never be made law in the first place. Okay.
Again, that's spot on. Yeah,
exactly. Okay, let us move on to our next story, and this is about pit toilets. So anyone who follows the news in South Africa will know that from time to time, one of the most terrible things that's reported in the news is that usually in very poor schools, usually in very rural areas, a small child will accidentally fall into a pit toilet and die. It's been, I think, at least two in the past 3 years or so that this has happened to two children who have died this way. And it, every time it happens, it reignites this debate about why South African government institutions, particularly schools in the country, have pit toilets at all. Pretty much every single election, I think the government has, the ANC has at some point promised to eradicate pit toilets entirely. They're most prevalent still in Limpopo and the Eastern Cape, I believe. Also, there's some in Mpumalanga. Recently, the Limpopo Department of Education has missed its own deadline to eradicate pit toilets. And this is after a number of legal challenges against the department. They were taken to court in 2018 and 2021, where the Limpopo High Court ordered the Department of Education Limpopo to continue to provide the court with plans to eradicate the school pit toilets every 6 months. This has still not happened. The Limpopo Department originally set a deadline for eradicating pit toilets in April of last year, and then had to extend this to April of this year, and it's missed that. However, it says that it's 80% of the way there, that of the 566, what they call priority one schools, which are schools without flushing toilets at all, 497 of them now have flushing toilets. This is continuously a really irritating thing, not just because of the enormously horrifying human costs that it has, but just that it kind of comes up every single election, and it just goes around and around and around. Some progress is being made, but I would not be surprised if the goal has not been entirely met by April of next year. Nandi, what do you make of this story?
Yes, Nick. Well, the problem of pits toilets is one hell of a frustrating thing, you know, because like it's because like the government is failing to eradicate them, and you know, I just want to quote some figures here that the AFW declares annual human rights card of 2023, which was published in March of this year, found that over 3,300 public schools still rely on pit toilets. So this shows that there's still a huge problem, and that the government is failing to deal with this issue. You know, so this is also another issue of issue of view. You know, that shows a government failure. You know, so the government is busy stealing funds that should be directed towards actually improving the state of a public school. So this is rather another case of government failure.
Yeah. You know, there's often this thing we hear from many government departments: oh, we don't have the money to fix this problem, or oh, the problems are so deep that there's no way we can fix them. I mean, I'm reminded of India, which has reduced the number of people without access to toilets from many hundreds of millions to, a number of like a quarter of that in the past couple of years, which is, you know, on a scale that South Africa doesn't seem to manage to accomplish. And I think the point here, Makone, is that it's not that the money is a problem. There is almost certainly enough money in the budget to eradicate pit toilets from our education institutions. We spend, a quarter of the government budget about on education. The problem is that the money is badly spent.
Agreed. So this show is one of those shows that aptly captures the state of South African politics. You have on one hand, 1.7 million being spent on dancing for Women's Day. That's being done by three men. Questionable, but yep, you have that. And then on the other hand, you have this issue that comes up every 5 years around the election season of pit toilets that children tragically die in, right? With children dying with no dignity, by the way, to fall to your death in a pit toilet, that the politicians involved just seem to play musical chairs and switching who's to blame for it. if you when you read further along down that article, you see them describe the sort of challenges they experience as to why they haven't been able to fix an issue that, one, you stated this, Nick, that the court had to instruct of them, and then the court had to create a timeline of them to keep them accountable, to keep them honest on their responsibility to eradicate pet toilets. And India is such a great example. India's pretty much collapsed its starvation and poverty numbers. I mean, India is just outstripping South Africa because its governance has significantly improved. But South Africa is still lacking quite tremendously and enormously, right, in tending to its key priorities, right? Let's leave the 2 million and focus on things that are honestly very, very important for children's lives, for children's education. To be using a pit toilet at school doesn't inspire any confidence in anything else about that school, to be quite fair. And so, yeah, this is one of those stories that are just so infuriating. One gets tongue-tied trying to explain the microcosm of problems. One of the things they said is the reason why they haven't been able to achieve a deadline that they set for themselves for the eradication of the pit latrines is that incompletion of projects, right? Which the Auditor General identifies constantly when you look at things like public health and public education as the reason why there's no improvement, especially in provinces like Limpopo and the Eastern Cape, the poorest provinces in the country. In completion of projects, that just means that a cater somewhere chowed the money, right? And so it's unfortunately very heartbreaking, but it aptly captures the state of South African politics, is that there is an absolute lack of priorities and that the poor are the ones who always stand to lose.
Exactly. All right. I think we've got time for one more story if we quickly rush to it. And this is about a story we actually talked about on Wednesday in the episode I did with Chris Hutting. We talked about how the Curo private schools group was being attacked on social media for posting pictures of a number of pretty small children. They look like, I don't know, grade ones, grade twos, grade noughts even, attending a careers day. And the reason that this post was being attacked is because there were, I think, four pictures or so. And one of the pictures had a white child play acting as a vet, and another one had a black child play acting as a cashier. And people on social media said that this was evidence of racial stereotyping in an attempt to, you know, demean black children and their potential career options. The department, the Gauteng Department of Education, which apparently seems to run itself on Twitter rather than actually improving education in the country, immediately said that it was going to launch an investigation into this and talk about the racial overtones and the unbalanced racial this and that. And well, very quickly, the whole thing appears to have collapsed. The parent of the girl in the photo said, "What is your problem? She was enjoying doing this. It doesn't mean that she's going to be branded for life. She has to go into a career of being a cashier now." It was, you know, it's little kids like play acting, you know, doing real jobs. Anyway, this has caused a rather rare occurrence, which is that the Gauteng Department of Education appears to have backtracked, saying that there are no racial undertones in the Curo social media post, according to their investigation. They said it in this rather sort of obfuscated, government-y, politically way, but the bottom line is it looks like the social media hero is going to go away. Londi, what do you make of this whole thing? This, to me, is a prime example of just how social media and sort of these people who try to divide and profit off of racial divisions are just so cynical and short-sighted.
Yes, yes, Nick. True. I mean, people like to make noise where there shouldn't be noise, and instead of focusing on things that are actually damaging a country, you're gonna focus on things that are petty. And you know, because I mean, being a cashier, firstly of all, I mean, firstly, it wasn't like a bad thing to be a cashier. You know, like the way everyone was, like, you know, people were, you know, were making noise on Twitter, you'd swear that, you know, being a cashier is a bad thing. And also, it's a tiny minority that found that to be, you know, racist or had racial undertones. But I mean, as you know, as you said, you know, it was kids that, you know, that were just like playing jobs, you know. So I mean, it wasn't really, you know, like that serious, you know. And like, it's good that the child of the I mean, that the mother of the child actually spoke out and said, "Oh no, look, kids are just playing, man. It's not something that's gonna, you know that should be taken very seriously." So, I mean, that is also, I mean, like that shows that, you know, that not all people are going to see things in a racial tone as it should, you know. So, yeah. So, I mean, I guess it's good that you know, that the government found that there's no undertone. It's good because, I mean, now we can move on to finally addressing bigger issues, for example, their failures, you know, in failing the people of the country.
McConnor, what really annoys me about stories like this is one of the worst things that happens here is people, Twitter has this particular, or X rather, has this rather strange effect on journalists and institutions, which is that you can get 100 comments under a post like this of people saying, "Oh, this is racist." And it really is just 100 people. But for some reason, people just assume that this is some great representative sample of the entire country and that, you know, the whole nation is talking about this issue on social media, which, if it hadn't gotten into the national news, probably have died there and then. What do you make of this, McConnor?
That's part of the outrage culture, right? That we are scouring through social media looking for things to be angry about and to protest. Because yeah, our lives would be far less interesting if you weren't doing that. But I have one thing to say about this, Nick, is that every now and then the mask falls off the politician's face and you see their absolute contempt for the working class. And this is a classic example. There's nothing wrong with being a cashier. It's a decent job. But for those who see this as a problem, as stereotyping, that tells you a lot about what views they secretly hold about people that hold down jobs like being a cashier.
No, exactly right. I can't remember the exact details, but I do remember once looking through a news article about some tweet that had created, that was described as having created outrage on social media. And I went and looked at the tweet to which they were referencing, and I believe there were about 4 people angry at the tweet. Look, apparently 4 people is enough to constitute national outrage. But anyway, okay, that is all the time we have for today. We will be back next week on the Daily Friend Show. We hope that you found today's show interesting. Have a good day, everyone. Cheers very much.